You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. And at this 1 o'clock time coming up, on Thursdays, it's the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, and Dave Gudnick. We're both here after 3 weeks separately. We had a couple things we wanted to tell you about before we got into kind of the examination of the news, that the Amy Goodman just mentioned that she'd be in town with her. The film, the Democracy Now! Film, tonight at 7 and 11:30 tomorrow, but unfortunately, it seems that all this is all sold out. So that's the word I've gotten. But anyway, there's a lot of people looking forward to it. Also, I want to tell you about that if you've never understood or heard about this Rethos, this Doors Open Minneapolis. It's this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. I have a subscription to the Star Tribune, and I got a paper copy. But it's all these places around town where you get to go in and look around and hear somebody give a spiel about this or that. Oh, one time a year ago, I went to the Federal Reserve. So I had a discussion about how they keep the money in the supply. And I went up to a few other places that are doing it. Anyway, there's a couple of dozens. Some are both Saturday and Sunday. Some are Saturday only, and some are Sunday only. Almost all are free, including this Saturday. KFAI is having a Saturday only, and if you want to kind of tour through community radio station tomorrow from 10 to 5, and that's at 1808 Riverside Avenue on the third floor.
Saturday,
yeah, tomorrow's Friday. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so that's two things coming up, and well, Dave, both of us watched the puppet parade, et cetera, this last Sunday. I went down Bloomington Avenue. I was so impressed with it. It was the most marching bands ever, I think, 12, 15, and all these different groups, and it was very political. Especially at the beginning, and he really had a feeling was anti-ICE, and that these people were a lot of them that probably did a lot of the opposition to the ICE and the malfeasance. A lot of, to my mind, justified talking about fascism, tried to make it some ugly head here, and it was so much fun. Came along there, and I had a big smile on my face as I watched it go down there. Dave, what were some of your opinions?
Well, similar, a lot of great costumes and like paper mache animals of all sizes. A lot of creativity was on display. It's also good to see in the parade lots of Mexican Americans participating. So it was a huge crowd. It was a good day, and I was glad the tradition is alive and well.
And this, well, I call them the steampunks, but these elaborate, huge vehicles that would rehab truck bases and whatever else, Ferris wheel on the back of a big truck bed. That was always fun. I like some of the ones the other years even better, but this was It's always funny. I wanted to make sure that I saw them. And so I'm glad it's really going strong.
Great to have some celebration in these rather dark times. The crowd mood was really great.
Well, Dave, you've got some, you took down some notes, and you've got some people you'd like to have us start hearing, because on the international scene, which we mostly deal with, it's just amazing what's happening.
Yeah, it's quite an action-packed period that we're in here, and lots to cover. I've probably got more notes than we can cover, but I have some quotes from the media and comments of my own, and we'll lead into several short clips from experts, former diplomats, American, Iranian, and European, so we'll see what we get to here. But I want to make mention a couple things about World War II, because in Ukraine, starting tomorrow, there's a two-day Russian ceasefire to honor the victory in the Great Patriotic War in 1945. Ukraine's participation is uncertain, but they've threatened the Moscow parade, and Moscow said you're going to get it back real heavily if you interfere with the parade in Moscow. That's the 9th. And also, Putin made some interesting comments about Israel nukes we'll touch on later. But it's a monumental date in 20th century history, and it's been insultingly and falsely minimized by Western propaganda. I don't want to repeat some of that, but it's really been disgraceful how they've tried to deny the role of the Soviet Union in defeating the Nazis, by far the most important factor.
And that is true because, I mean, not only were there some at least 20 million Russians.
27 killed.
27 million killed. But the German Sixth Army went through the Ukraine, and they were stopped in this 800-day battle that broke the back of the Nazi German army.
Another historical note from the late great comedian George Carlin: Germany lost the war, but the Nazis won. Why does he say that? That's because we integrated the best of Nazi spies and scientists into our Western networks to fight the Soviet Union. And in Ukraine, the Banderites and others kept the Nazi spirit intact, again aided by the CIA.
Now, the Banderites were the Nazi group which has lineages right up to today in the Ukraine.
Yep, and allied groups supported by the CIA through the 60s and 70s and back again today. Now even Europe is learning what Russia and Iran know well. The U.S. is untrustworthy. It has lost trust. It is unreliable. It is agreement incapable. This kind of thing is even creeping into the mainstream now. Here's Claudia Major from New York Times of just today. Turning points are usually only clear in retrospect, but Iran and the Greenland crisis may prove to be the turning points that confirmed what negotiations over Ukraine merely suggested. The United States, far from being an ally of Europe, acts against Europe. And here's a comment from a European online commentator, Simplicius, also today. The carnival, referring to the Trump administration, is in its last season, and it's beginning to show its age, appearing at times both erratic and woefully rehearsed to exasperated audiences. The latest spectacle saw Trump launch an ill-fated and ill-planned Project Freedom, a kind of freedom of navigation gimmick in Hormuz, which immediately flopped hours later when U.S. destroyers attempting to cross the strait were targeted by Iran. The entire charade was particularly confused. For instance, the official U.S., quote, guidance for this bizarro stunt essentially told daring vessels to chance it through Omani territorial waters in the hopes it would avoid Iranian strikes. So we had another version of Taco Tuesday, Taco Trump, but Trump always chickens out, TACO Tuesday. Trump abandoned Project Freedom within a day or so. No real negotiations. I'll have more that you may not know on this in just a second. No real negotiations, at least officially, but other reports continue. Rumors and reports of negotiations. And for sure happening. More ugly insider trader market manipulation, making millions for some people. It's again evident. Iran Foreign Ministry had its own concise report, announcement about these Axios report. Axios has close ties to the White House and reports whatever they want reported. But the Iran Foreign Ministry said, Axios has reported an imminent Iran deal 5 times in 19 days. 5 times. No deal. Same reporter. Same sources. Same White House. Same Israeli intelligence contacts.
Well, the Trump and the White House want total capitulation by Iran. Well, that's not going to happen.
That's right. And the uranium enrichment issue, which they refuse to concede on, has actually been put on the back burner, and now we're just trying to get a closing to the war. Here's some concise news summaries, one-liners from the past week. I'm trying to come up with a little bit of memorable and humorous and these clever marketing of war campaigns has changed its name so often, even Secretary of State Rubio got confused about whether Project Freedom was still on or not. And Iranian leader Ghalibaf says it should be called Operation Trust Me, Bro, and it failed. And also the foreign minister, Arachi, said we've gone from Project Freedom to Project Deadlock. Here's my version. We have gone from Project Epic Epstein Fury to Project Freedom to Project Failure. Or perhaps, as someone I read said, just Project Free Dumb and Dumber. All right, let's have a little few words, just 2 or 3 minutes from Jeffrey Sachs, a well-known professor at Columbia University with a lot of international experience and economic development experience going back decades. And he's on the Judge Napolitano show for an interview. And let's have just a few minutes from him. Don, you've got to turn it on.
It is on.
Okay, let's see what we got going here. Well, not getting the sound. Let's check the settings here.
Negotiations. You don't send Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff to negotiate. This is ridiculous. It's without any rational process, and there hasn't been one. And every time one looks at the situation as it gets more and more dire, it seems less and less rational. Mm. And the closer one looks at all of this, I think the fair thing to say is the United States government is in the hands of a few people who have grabbed power. The congressional Republican leadership is absolutely as if they don't exist, as if they don't understand anything about their constitutional responsibility. They have just completely, totally disappeared, except on the occasional vote when they say we don't want to have anything to do with any of these decisions. And we don't hear any coherence from any senior government official. Our entire political life revolves around Truth Social posts. And this seems to be an accurate reflection of how our government works right now. And so I think none of this makes sense in terms of American interests, in terms of military capacity, in terms of likely consequences. And if what is happening right now by report turns out to be the case, if we go back to a full war, again, lots of ifs there, I apologize, because I think this is a crucial moment, and so I want to state the conditional.
Right.
If we go back to a full shooting war, we will look back at these next 2 weeks as among the most consequential in years or decades, because a lot will be destroyed that will not be rebuilt anytime soon.
Okay, that's Professor Jeffrey Sachs, and we've had him on before, and I'm sure we'll have him on again. Here's a quick summary from another good commenter, Jeremy Scahill, an investigative journalist. President Donald Trump is scrambling to find a way to declare victory in a war against Iran, vacillating between public demands to make a deal and threats to unleash a new round of massive bombing. The U.S. naval blockade on the Strait of Hormuz has sparked a global economic and energy crisis, and neither the blockade nor Trump's threats have resulted in Iranian capitulation or a willingness to forfeit any of its rights to control maritime traffic in the Strait. Before getting on to more about the Iran war, I want to point to what I think is another brilliant summary. This one's by Professor Pape, P-A-P-E, of the University of Chicago, who pointed to the parallel of the U.S. corporate path and the U.S. imperial path. Has four parts. Starts with hubris. Then it leads to overreach. Then it leads to denial. Then it leads to escalation. Unfortunately, this is the path we've been on. One more thing about the Mideast that's important that got hardly any coverage was that Putin just a few days ago added the demand that Israel become subject to international nuclear arms inspections. This would be a tremendous move, would shake the whole relationship in the region, and it hasn't been talked about much internationally and hardly at all in the U.S. media, because they don't want to acknowledge the outlaw nation that has probably a couple hundred nuclear weapons and has threatened to use them and may indeed still use them. So that kind of upped the discussion a little there with the demand from Putin, or a suggestion, let's put it. So, again, back to Project Freedom. Why was it quickly ended? Well, for one thing, Iran fired upon and forced two ships to turn around. But an important announcement by NBC just yesterday said Saudi Arabia was angered by the initiation of this war without their being consulted, and they have closed their airspace to the U.S. Trump surprised these Gulf allies by announcing Project Freedom on social media Sunday afternoon, angering the leadership not only in Saudi Arabia, but also now Kuwait and other Gulf countries had said they're not going to allow U.S. military to fly aircraft from their air bases. So this is a serious change in the situation over there. And as I mentioned previously on this program, there's at least half a dozen European countries who also strongly disagree with the war on Iran and have denied or attempting to deny the use of their airspace in pursuit of this war. So there's a lot of countries in the Gulf and in Europe and elsewhere, of course, turning against this. Meanwhile, the latest new, quote, negotiator for the U.S. is Nick Stewart, another Zionist who is with the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, which is another front group. It should be Foundation for Defense of Israel. So these are the kind of people who have negotiated, real estate cronies and Zionists, and it's no wonder nothing is resulting from it. We don't actually believe in diplomacy in this country, and that's really a problem when you've lost trust and you've lost the ability to recognize the need for international negotiations. Wall Street Journal indicates that the Trump one-pager, the fact of a one-pager is itself an embarrassment, included nuclear enrichment demands, but Iran has clearly said it has a right to enrichment and will not give that up. Iran has also proposed putting off any discussion of nuclear enrichment to a later phase, since it took years to work out the fine points of the JCPOA, which was the nuclear agreement negotiated under Obama and trashed by Trump. And now we're lucky if we can get back to having such an agreement. German foreign minister says Israel is doing, quote, our dirty work in Iran. Meanwhile, as reported in the current local WHAM newsletter, Linda Blimes of Harvard Kennedy School estimated long-term costs of the Iran war at $1 trillion due to U.S. troops' long-term treatment for exposure to environmental toxins. War in mainstream media is showing increasing criticism of the Trump administration, and a new Washington Post lengthy report of yesterday explained that the damage to U.S. military facilities in the Gulf was much greater than initially stated by the administration. So again, important redefinition of the military landscape over there. Here's one more. We'll get to Alistair Cook, a prominent former diplomat, in one more minute. One more quote from a Christopher Caldwell in the New York Times of just 2 days ago. Short quote, the American-Israeli attack on Iran was more than a bad idea. It has turned into a watershed in the decline of the American empire. It would be wrong to say the United States is trapped in the war it started. It has options, but it is now going to pay a very steep price no matter which of them it chooses.
Yeah, well, we have for quite a while had people on saying the Trump administration has no off-ramps, no way to get out of it, and they're just flailing about, coming up with this, coming up with that. And when they have some missive coming directly from Trump, first the left hand is a good guy and the right hand is, we'll wipe you off the map forever.
And we have an adolescent president and an adolescent nation unable to humbly admit that it screwed up and to back up a little bit. So here's another interview on Judge Napolitano by Alistair Crook, a very experienced diplomat in the Mid-East region, and just a fairly brief comment from him about the lack of resolution to the situation. You ready there, Don?
You're ready.
Of aspirations for the future. And if so, isn't it true that amongst Israel, the United States, and Iran, there is no such commonality?
Yes, that's true. I think the basic premise before you can start politics, can start negotiation, you have to be able to say, listen, I don't agree with that other person. I disagree with his history. I disagree with his vision of the future. But I do accept he has a right to that vision. I do agree it is a legitimate vision of his people, even if it's at the end. If people won't accept that, if they cannot say that that is true, then it's very hard to have any negotiations at all. And that is very much what you have now. You have a completely different, where there's very, almost nothing, if you like, in commonality about the vision of Iran for the future, the vision of its history, and Israel's vision of the future, and Israel's account of history. And America is also in a different place. So it's very hard to have any political situation when you go that far. And also, I think it's going to be very hard because the basic request of demand of Iran, the basic demand of Iran is an end to the war. It's guarantees against further aggression by Israel and America. But how is Trump going to do that? Is it possible for Trump to do that? I don't know. I think it's very difficult for him to do that because his credibility is so broken. No one trusts the United States government on their word is not sufficient. Is a treaty possible? Well, I think that's unlikely in the present context of the Congress. Is Trump capable of actually proposing an end to conflict in a sincere, credible way? I think that's pretty much unlikely too. And I don't think also that it's very likely that Israel is prepared to accept an end of conflict until it has met all its objectives. So I think probably no is the answer.
Wow.
That again was Alistair Crook, experienced diplomat, summarizing the current rather bleak circumstances for ending the war. We now have some brief comments from another interesting personage in the news. It's Professor Morandi. He's actually a professor of literature and a related field in the University of Tehran. He was born in the United States in Virginia, but now he's a prominent international speaker on behalf of Iran. He jokes that it's not an official position. He wishes they'd offer him one and maybe pay him, but he's just you know, a patriotic Iranian, and we've got him for a couple different brief clips. First one is about 3 minutes, or I'm sorry, the first one is just two and a half minutes about life in Tehran, and here's what he has to say.
Professor Morandi, it's a pleasure. Welcome here. Let me start by asking you about life in Tehran today, with the bombing stop, but President Trump seeming to threaten a resumption almost every day.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Judge. It's always a great honor. It's life is normal. People are very much used to Trump's threats. One day he says he'll obliterate the country. Another day he says he'll send us back to the Stone Age. Another day he'll say he'll wipe out our he'll wipe out our civilization. So nothing is new when he makes new threats. I think it's pretty clear that Iranians are expecting another assault on the country, quite possibly in the coming hours or days. The Axios piece obviously was an attempt to manipulate the markets. People here believe that people close to Trump or Witkoff or Kushner have made a lot of money over the last few hours. But the story, of course, is not true. The Iranians are not going to negotiate their nuclear rights. And at the moment, the Iranians have been clear that they are first going to negotiate the ceasefire, and then they'll negotiate the 10-point plan that was agreed upon by Trump himself. So it's going to be, so people know that, and they know that Trump demands some sort of victory, and here no one is in the mood to give him that sort of victory. So that means that there'll probably be more airstrikes, more missile strikes, perhaps troops launched against the Iranians. We hear that there are large numbers of troops in Kuwait and in the Emirates, that there are fighter jets in Qatar, in Saudi Arabia, and the Emirates too. So since people follow the news very closely for obvious reasons, I think no one would be surprised to hear airstrikes or hear the sound of bombs at any time.
That's Professor Morandi. We'll have another brief statement from him in just a second here. He is a professor of English literature and Orientalism, a field that reveals Western prejudice toward the Orient. And now, sometimes the internet is not so great from Tehran, so his voice sometimes breaks up, but I've tried to capture some of the better comments here. Here he's talking about what could be brought upon Iran by if there's an escalation.
So maybe he could put a good word in for me somewhere. I think it's it's the real question, George, for me, is that Trump has, until up to now, said he's going to obliterate Iran. He said he's going to send Iran back to the Stone Age. He said he's going to wipe out the Iranian civilization. And now he says this. There, in Western media, we haven't seen any outrage in the UK, in the US. We haven't seen bold headlines condemning him for this. And we haven't seen a single major journalist, these journalists that have millions of followers or hundreds of thousands of followers, who knows how many of them are real or not, but None of them have shown outrage, not before and not now. It's normal to say, but if you heard to say this about Iran, but if someone in Iran, let's say some obscure MP from some far off city in Iran that I've never even heard of, comes out and says, we will wipe the French people from the face of the earth, or we will wipe the French people. Imagine the outrage or the response of Western media, which we often see. Some person who is not even in charge, they quote him and then they attribute things to him, or they misquote him, or they distort what he says. We've seen that a lot, how they would twist the wording and then make what the president or some former president had to say. But here, Trump, an English speaker, not the greatest of English speakers, but he has said the same thing in different ways so many times that it's clear as day what he's threatening to do. He's threatening to carry out the most horrific Holocaust in human history by far. And even if he doesn't choose to carry this out, this is itself terrorism. You're being threatened. Your entire family, your neighbors, your neighborhood, your city is being threatened to be demolished. But complete indifference in the West. We also saw this earlier when he spoke about Cuba. And we should never forget what's going on in Cuba either. The Cuban people are besieged and they're being terrorized, and Trump has threatened in the past to destroy Cuba. But again, no outrage, nothing in the so-called civilized world. So they've demonized us so much in the Western media. They've depicted us as subhuman for so long that it doesn't bother any of these elites. I know that it outrages many, many decent people in the UK and in the US and across the world and across the West. But among the elites, the Epstein class, it's not even something that deserves to be discussed, apparently.
Well, there again, Professor Mirandi and his aside about so-called civilization reminds me of the famous remark by Gandhi, who was asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said, "I think it's a fine idea."
If they would only
of course,
do it.
You make the.
Sorry. So that was Professor Mirandi. Now I want to refer.
Before you go to there.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's for 47 years is a date which many of the Washington politicals talk about. Iran has been against us. We should be able to get away with anything because they're against us. But what happened in 47 years ago? The horrific Shah that had been installed by the U.S. and Britain with the overthrow of the democratic elected government in Iran, who wanted to nationalize the oil for the benefit of the Iranians, was overthrown by Kermit Roosevelt of CIA and the MI6 from the United Kingdom. And this was horrific. Treatment of the Iranian people, and they were glad to overcome and get that, and things went through quite a few iterations.
Well, the political repression was so severe, it was notorious internationally under the Shah, that the only place for good discussion was in the mosque, and this is why it had a religious base to the revolution that occurred. Okay, well, I want to quote a couple more things before getting to Mike Adams, who's an American analyst, going to say some pretty dramatic things about the coming economic crisis. But just a couple more things first about Iran and the Mideast. Trump's threat, this is Kit Clarenberg, another good journalist, Trump's threat to Iran not to block the strait were ignored. The riddle of why Washington was so caught off guard is answered by Netanyahu's personal assurances to Trump the Islamic Republic would collapse in mere days. Astonishingly, there was no contingency plan beyond that. End of that quote. Now, here's my comment. Note the parallel overconfidence in 2014 in Ukraine that extreme sanctions would cripple Russia, and lack of planning beyond those sanctions, which were expected to lead to regime change. That's leaving aside U.S. strategy to break Europe, as was mentioned earlier, weaken Europe. So there's a parallel U.S. strategic failure and defeats in both places. NATO expansion has been stymied in Ukraine despite extreme sanctions that were predicted to result in Russian regime change. U.S.-Israel attack on Iran twice in less than a year during fake negotiations. After years of extreme sanctions followed by attack to achieve regime change also has failed. The other parallel is the technical change in war, both Ukraine and Iran-Israel wars, described by Chaz Freeman on Glenn Deason's show. We may get to that today. And another interesting revelation that came out in the mainstream, again, recent CNN report said that the, quote, sole, unquote, strategy, that is the only strategy for the West to defeat Russia, was and is to encourage internal collapse, just what I was saying. This was according to, quote, European intelligence, which is thoroughly CIA as well. Yet neither Russia nor Iran are likely to fail. It is the West that is failing. Meanwhile, as I mentioned before, with little notice in the Western media, Putin says Iran restrictions should also extend to Israel nukes. So the issue is out in open now. Putin's remarks about the Gulf being weapons of mass destruction free are a very big deal indeed over the medium and long term. It's the first time that Russia has put its foot down in this conflict. This is a shot across the Zionist bow, and any remaining Israeli officials who are arguably sane are rethinking their plans. Bottom line, no Israel nukes equals no greater Israel. Meanwhile, economic consequences continue to worsen. I have several things I'd like to bring to people's attention there. The blockades are mostly working for both Iran and U.S., so there's a lot of confusion and the fog of war around that. But ship operators don't want to risk their vessels being captured or damaged. There's an insurance problem, and it really is a mostly effective blockade for both sides at this point. Another longtime energy commentator, Art Berman, says, quoting a prominent Kepler industry newsletter, which projects that flows through the Strait of Hormuz will be at only 40% of pre-war levels a year from now. For all of you who have enjoyed criticizing peak oil for the last decade, the joke is on you. And here's the phrase everyone is learning this year, supply chain shock. Supply chains are seriously interrupted and not soon repaired. The economic pain increases by the day. Iran is likely to outlast the U.S., which apparently plans another attack. So here's Mike Adams on the Daniel Davis deep dive program for about 4 minutes on some of the consequences of the oil and commodities prices because of the Gulf of Oman.
Iran hits the GCC energy, what happens then?
Well, I don't like to use the term Mad Max, but in that scenario that you just described, with the near complete destruction of the energy infrastructure and Iran retaliating against the Gulf nations, then billions die over time. And then we have mass social unrest, we have social upheaval, we have revolutions, we have war, chaos. And I'm not talking about the United States for all those things. I'm saying all over the world.
Yeah, and help us to understand here, because when I think, I'm like, okay, I'm looking at global oil and I'm thinking, okay, 20% comes through the Strait of Hormuz. And so, okay, well, if we lost all that, we still got 80% out here. So maybe we'll have to tighten our belts a little bit, but it won't be that bad. But you're saying it would be worse than that. How just to help us understand the math, how can 20% equal global famine?
Because it's the cost. The energy has been abundant this whole time. Food has been cheap because energy was cheap. Energy was cheap because the ships were sailing 120 a day through the strait. So many countries, and I'm saying billions of people in this world, including nearly a billion in India, live on the edge of poverty right now. They are marginally just barely able to afford to eat now. So even if you can grow the food, you can't grow the food at scale with the economics that can be afforded by billions of people who are living on this planet. That's the issue. Does that make sense?
Unfortunately, it does. That I wish it didn't. And in the event that combat operations return and they start hitting these things, what can other countries around the world do? Is there any way to mitigate it once that starts happening?
Well, let me answer it this way. You know, Trump announced over the weekend Project Freedom as a humanitarian mission to free these ships out of the Persian Gulf. In my opinion, if Trump wanted to do the most humanitarian thing possible, he should leave the Persian Gulf and let Iran charge its tolls, let the ships flow, because that will save hundreds of millions of lives in the long run. The humanitarian thing to do, in my opinion, again, is for the United States to stop this war, negotiate some deal of peace, an end of this war, and learn to get along with the other nations of the world, whether it's Russia or China or Iran or whoever. Because we are very fragile in our global system right now, food and energy, all the things that we've talked about. It's very fragile. We are one hair trigger away from the destruction of the infrastructure that keeps at least 4 billion people alive, you know, through the economics and the energy, the hydrocarbons that we just talked about. But, you know, there are other things here. There are certain, like sulfuric acid, for example. It's the number one most important chemical in industry around the world. And we're not getting the sulfuric acid that we used to get. And did you know that without sulfuric acid, you can't pull rare earths out of mine tailings? You need the acid in order to acidify and put rare earths into solution so you can extract them later on. The sulfuric acid comes as a side effect out of all of the energy mining or extraction out of the Middle East. So there are other critical factors here that are chilling game changers. If we don't restore the flow of helium and sulfuric acid and hydrocarbons and polyethylene, you start to get a domino effect that destroys the supply chains that make modern life possible.
That again was Mike Adams, energy and commodity analyst on the Glenn Deason show. Glenn Deason is a Norwegian professor, does great interviews. And now just have one more speaker, Chaz Freeman, a very experienced, elderly, former diplomat with a lot of experience in Middle East and Israel, and he is on the Glenn Deason show and discussing first some changes in warfare that again point to the parallels between the Ukraine and Middle East or Iranian conflicts, because the drones and missiles have changed the nature of things.
And so now reliant on railroads to take some of their oil to China overland. The U.S. and Israel have been bombing the rail lines, but it turns out that railroad workers are very good at repairing bombed rail lines. We should have learned that in Vietnam, where there were 300,000 Chinese military engineers who kept the railroads operating for the Vietnamese and defended them with their defenses during the Indochina War. I think you're right to point to the fragility of the petrodollar at present, and quite correct to say, I think probably the UAE told the U.S. Treasury, look, we don't have any revenue in dollars anymore, and if you don't give us dollars to use for our trade, we're going to have to move primarily to the Chinese yuan. And this, of course, is a direct strike at American global financial hegemony, and it explains the swap arrangement that you mentioned. It is, I don't think there's a final element here, and that is that the Chinese evidently judge that the United States has caused such confusion internationally in financial markets, that instead of passively resisting sanctions, against the purchase of Iranian oil, they can actively oppose that. And there's now an order from the equivalent of an executive order in the United States, an order from the central government in China to Chinese banks and oil companies not to respect the newest American sanctions. So this is a direct attack on the weaponization of the dollar by the United States. I don't know what the outcome will be. Not all attacks succeed, as we've just seen in the case of Iran. You can attack Iran, but that doesn't mean Iran must capitulate. So what is going on is, and to go back to the word checkmate, is a checkmate or a stalemate. There are no negotiations. There is no military means of opening the Strait of Hormuz at acceptable cost. Ships trying to run that gauntlet would be destroyed. It may be that the cruise missiles that the Iranians fired at American ships, which allegedly did no damage or were shot down or diverted somehow, did not strike those ships. That's what the Central Command declares, contrary to the Iranian claim that they struck them. But it really doesn't matter. They keep these ships at bay, which is all that is required. There are no negotiations. So, well, I just basically say there are two ways to open the strait. One is military, and that won't work. And the other way is to negotiate with Iran and reach a compromise. And there is no negotiation at all. In fact, Stephen Witkoff, the misbegotten envoy of the United States, with a perfect record of failure in every international negotiation he's entered, now has a new deputy called, I think, Nick Stewart, who is from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, which is a Mossad front in Washington. And he is on record publicly as opposing all negotiations with Iran on the usual Zionist grounds. So I think the negotiations that have taken place have essentially been performative, intended to manipulate capital markets and, manipulate public opinion and oil prices to the benefit of somebody, large benefit to corrupt officials in the United States and elsewhere. So what does this mean? This means that contrary to what you and I have often discussed, there will be no negotiated resolution of this war. It will probably subside into something resembling the previous situation where we had a low intensity conflict ongoing between Israel and Iran that went on for decades. Prime Minister Netanyahu has openly stated that he spent 40 years trying to find a president he could talk into joining Israel and attacking Iran in the manner that they have. I think this has been quite a disillusioning experience for the United States. It was opposed by the U.S. military, clearly. Civilians are always more bloodthirsty than the military, who recognize that they could get killed if they get into a war. The warriors are always more enthusiastic about diplomacy than civilians for that reason. But there was no diplomacy, there was only a war, and it hasn't worked out. And so I think the implication is, If we're talking about no resolution, we're talking about a return to a lower level intensity conflict, perhaps eliminated from time to time by explosions, then Israel will not have the United States with it to renew an attack on Iran. That puts Israel in a very different position than it has been, and I think it's something to watch. Will the United States, with respect to Iran, will it continue to have Israel's back militarily and politically? And I suspect the answer is going to be ambivalent and ambiguous, not clear.
be getting back to Ambassador Chas Freeman in just a second. I was going to spend a few minutes in closing here with his comments about Israel behavior, which I think really needs to be said over and over. I believe their actions have not only morally corrupted Israel in a deep way, but also those of us in the United States who are making this all possible. For example, a Washington Post reporter just a few days ago in a column advocated assassinating the Iranian negotiators. This is the mentality that we've sunk to. And I want to get a few more comments from the ambassador here.
Ron, could that also imply that the U.S. would have to walk away from the relationship with Israel? You alluded to something along those lines before.
Yes, I think that's the clear implication. And, you know, if you look at youth polling in the United States, you find that Israel is extremely unpopular. Maybe that's too weak a statement. Many people positively loathe it for what it does. And I'm not speaking just of Christian Americans or Muslim Americans. I'm talking about Jewish Americans as well. The many Jewish communities in the United States, the younger people in them, don't want anything to do with Israel. So the base of support, well, you look at in the Democratic Party, you've got 6% support for Israel. It's considerably more. It's a plurality in the Republican Party, but it's declining. The evidence of, you know, the things that the people around Netanyahu are doing. For example, Ben-Gvir's birthday, his wife gives him a cake with a gallows on it. We're watching the gasification of southern Lebanon. We're watching Israel commit acts of piracy off Crete, taking people off an aid flotilla, beating them up badly, kidnapping some of them. And a complete contempt for any decency or rules of law on the part of Israel, which is deeply disquieting to those people who have traditionally supported Israel, whatever it did, and very offensive to everyone else. So it just, you know, as someone said, it's not my judgment, but someone said the Netanyahu is the single Jew who has done the most to promote anti-Semitism since the murder of Jesus Christ by Jews. You know, he has taken the flag of Israel with its six-pointed star and made that the equivalent in most people's minds of a swastika, replicating the worst crimes of European fascism. Does this end well for Israel? I can't imagine it does. I don't know how many people have left Israel for other climes. I know that there are all kinds of discussions of Jewish colonies here, there, and everywhere. I mean, Milei, the rather odd president of Argentina, who is an ardent Zionist, apparently has been talking about a colony of 300,000 Israelis in Patagonia, which, you know, nothing wrong with that, I suppose, but it's hardly supportive of the continued existence of the Zionist state in West Asia. I think that Israel's future is now very dubious. And the same thing seems to be happening to it that happened to the Christian Crusader kingdoms established in the same locale, 800 years ago, 700, 800 years ago. They didn't last a century, neither of them. Israel's getting up there, but I think it's looking very dubious that it will survive, given its status as an international pariah, and the, its loss of support among the people in the United States and some European countries that have ardently supported it.
That's again Ambassador Chaz Freeman. I'm going to give him 3 more minutes.
No, the collapse of his...
Sorry, get right back to Chaz Freeman in a second here. I want to make a comment about that Argentine colony. It may not be legitimate because it appears that the Zionists are trying to establish it, are setting fires to reduce the value of the land so they can then buy it up. So this is another one of their international friendly tactics. So just a few minutes more here from Chaz Freeman on the Glenn Deason Show. See if I can find the right spot.
So you're right. And even though I don't know what the basis for American guilt about Holocaust is, I think, you know, we joined the Soviet Union in liberating the death camps. But, I mean, of course, we had anti-Semitism, I think a much milder form than Europeans did. Anyway, we supported Israel emotionally. That's all been stripped away by behavior that can only be described as evil. You know, killing babies, bombing hospitals, striking, destroying churches and mosques, murdering people who are trying to get food, sniping at them, killing kids with shots in the head and the belly, and shooting people in the knee, rather, and to cripple them. Kidnapping, piracy, torture, sodomy in the jails. We've seen every horror you can imagine. It's not surprising that attitudes have changed. And, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of time in my early retirement basically seeing what Israel was becoming and trying to save it from itself by speaking out against the evolution that it was undergoing. And of course that had no effect except to win ostracism for me. So I'm on blacklists and so forth, which I now take as a badge of honor, but I was rather annoyed at it at the time. I think Israel... And it's not just Netanyahu, by the way. I mean, he's certainly guilty of many things, and his insistence on staying in power because he's a wartime prime minister is, frankly, enormously destructive to Israeli interests. But you have 80% of Israelis, apparently, according to polls, supporting the war with Iran. So this is a... It's not just an individual, it's a society that is sociopathic, not mentally healthy. I don't know where, you know, who wants Israelis who have been committing war crimes. You know, I guess there's an issue in Britain now with a dozen dual nationals who are known to have committed war crimes, and they... British establishment is just leaving them alone, but the public is energized against them. You can foresee a future in which to be Israeli is to be unable to travel, to gain entry to any country because of the reputation that the world's most moral army, as they used to call themselves, has established for itself.
So there you have it. The moral standing of Israel going down.
Yeah, that helped defeat the Democrats in the last presidential election. On the way over here, I listened to the headlines, and a week or so ago, Secretary of War Defense Hegseth said the cost of the war for the U.S. has been $25 billion, and there was a headline that it was $72 billion now, and so a better calculation. And so it...
Don't forget, it's $1 trillion when you add all the damage to the vets that suffer for years and years afterwards.
And one last thing if you still want to find out more about that, Doors Open Minneapolis, downtown in South Minneapolis, doorsopenminneapolis.org, or Rethos Doors Open Minneapolis, R-E-T-H-O-S. This has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Dave Gudnick and Don Olson.